I've made that mistake myself before, Joyce. Sorry. Good job. You're fine. You did great. Hey, everybody. I'm Marcia Stone, and I'm an alcoholic. Hey, it's my honor and my privilege to introduce our speaker tonight. You know, every now and then someone comes along who comes through this program that has the type of psychic change and entire transformation that is just so inspiring to watch. And this woman is one of those people. I remember I was kind of reminiscing with a coworker this evening about the day that Libby checked in to this recovery center. And if I'm not mistaken, it was a Sunday. It was either a Saturday or Sunday. I know it was the weekend. And I recall standing on the front porch and seeing the car pull up, and her father got out of the car and came around, and we shook hands, and I introduced myself, and I said, "Well, where's Elizabeth?" And he kind of looked back at the car. He walks back over to the car and opens up the passenger door on the back seat. And as he opens the door, I see Libby sitting there, and she's not responding to me. And we're saying, "Libby? Elizabeth?" And she was... She was absolutely either unwilling or unable, and I believe unable, to communicate with me at that point. but we did manage to get her out, and and to go from that point to where she is today is nothing short of miraculous. She came in here and she was angry. And she was resentful. She was antisocial. And more than anything, she was completely terrified of life. And it was our pleasure to work with her. I was a program director at the time. And to be able to mentor her through her work. And I've become really close to her and to her family. And I'm just so incredibly proud of her. Today she is... She's a powerful woman in recovery. She helps a ton of people, and she's got a wonderful message of experience, strength, and hope to share. So you guys are in for a real treat. I'll give you Miss Libby.
Hi, my name's Libby, and I'm a grateful recovered drug addict. And she is correct. I was unable to respond, I'm pretty sure. So before I get started, you know, I can't help but think back to the first time that I was in, you know, what is now Mark Houston Hall. I was about 24 hours out of detox. I was miserable. I was angry. I was broken. As I recall, it was an alumni reunion, you know, and so there were hundreds of people here, and I remember seeing lights and these families being reunited after long stints apart, and everyone seemed so happy. And I remember sitting in this corner right over there and just crying and crying and thinking, like, these people are either full of BS or they're high. Like, how? You know, this can't really exist. And a man that some of you guys know came up to me at that point, and he said, "You know, I'm not sure who you are, but I want to tell you, whatever you think you are, you're not." And that kept me just present enough and just curious enough as to what he was talking about to try to be present for the rest of that evening. So to have come full circle and to be back here tonight in this capacity simply blows me away, and I'm really grateful to be here. So I wanted to start off with that. That being said, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, what happened in my life and kind of what led up to me arriving at what was then Mark Houston Recovery. But really, I want to talk a lot about what my experience was like here and what happened here and what my life is like today, because it is beyond anything I ever could have imagined, and that's the absolute truth. So I grew up in a family, I had an absolutely wonderful family. You know, education was very important in our family, and from a very young age, that was how I realized today how I sought power. I remember always kind of feeling different somehow, just like I didn't quite fit in. And that's something I hear a lot in the rooms. When a lot of people speak, I hear them say, you know, I feel like I missed the first day of kindergarten, and on that day, like, they gave out this secret code book to life. and I wasn't there, and I just didn't get my copy, and I didn't know what was going on from then forward. But never quite feeling a part of, you know, that's just my experience. And looking back, you know, there's really nothing in my childhood that would make that so. You know, there was no negative, just cataclysmic event that I could really look back at and say, okay, well, this is what did it. Like, this is why I am the way I am. I just assumed that maybe everybody felt the same way I did, but they just did a lot better job of acting like they didn't feel that way. So it was always about, like, seeking power and finding a way to feel differently than how I felt. And it took me a long time to make that realization. I remember sitting in Marcia's office during one of our mentoring sessions, and she asked me what seemed like a pretty general question. She said, when was the last time you were truly happy? And I sat, and I thought, and I thought, and I thought back, and I realized, like, I cannot remember a specific instance. There may have been one in childhood long ago that I don't recall. But where I was just okay in my own skin. You know, and today that's not the case, but we'll get to that. So, you know, it was all about school and education and studying, and, you know, I was that straight-A honor student that everyone had a bright future prepared for, and science was really what interested me, and that was what I spent a lot of time doing. I was the one in all of the extracurricular activities. You know, I wanted to apply to all the right schools and have the right scholarship and have the right career. And it was always, you know, if I just have this, then I'll be okay. And it would be okay for a little while. Not long, but a little while. And then it would be like, well, here's the next thing. It must be this. Like, that's what I'm missing. So if I just get this, then I'll be okay. And nothing was ever sufficient to change that way that I felt inside. You know, and sometimes it was more pronounced than others. There were times where things were kind of status quo and it was just this mild unhappiness. But wherever I went and whatever I did, I always felt it. And I always looked back and, you know, tried to think, like, what happened to me to make me like this? Like, I realized that I'm somehow not like other people. What is it that happened? You know, searching for that explanation and continuing to seek out power through material possessions and school. You know, and another common theme in my life was this absolute delusion that the rules that apply to every single one of you guys just do not apply to me. And that is a common theme. An example of that would be, I don't know if you guys have experienced this, but a lot of times, like in elementary school, they'll tell you, well, you may not have to study too much right now, but when you get to middle school, it's going to be harder, and you're going to have to, like, do the work that everyone else does. And I was like, okay, okay. So I got to middle school, and that wasn't the case. And, you know, so going into high school, I was kind of told the same thing. Well, high school's not like middle school. Like, you're going to have to actually do the work that other people do. You're not going to keep these grades. Okay. All right. So I get to high school, and it's still not the case, you know, and I certainly studied a lot and did my work, but the way that I saw other people study, I just didn't have to do it. And that's just one example of something that kind of fueled the fire that, you know, these rules that I see everybody else follow, for whatever reason, I'm immune to that, and I simply don't have to do it. You know, and somewhere deep down, subconsciously, I truly believed that. You know, that being said, again, there really was nothing that negative that happened to me. My sister and I did not want for very much. You know, we had two very educated parents. You know, my dad has a PhD, my mom has a doctorate in another area. You know, so my story is not one of, oh, I had this horrendous childhood and that's why I did what I did. I had no idea what it was. So drugs first came into this. I was about 18 years old, I think, and, you know, I was driving a brand new car that my dad had gotten for me. was just kind of driving along this really curvy stretch of road one night, and this car just came out of nowhere, and I basically plowed into him. The first of many events that I was very lucky to walk away from alive. And honestly, I believe that it has nothing to do with luck and everything to do with the power of God, is the truth. But the car was totaled, you know, and I got this little shoulder injury. And I just kept going to the doctor, and I went to physical therapy, and nothing was working. And at that point, you know, opiates and Vicodin were just a class of substances I had studied in school because I was a real neuropharmacology geek, and I knew all about it. But I had no experience with it, and so I just thought, oh, okay, here's another medicine they're going to give me that's not going to work. So I went home that night, and I was like, well, yeah, my shoulder's kind of hurting. I think I'll give this a go, see what happens. Nothing happened right away, but about 30 minutes later, all of a sudden, like, everything that had been wrong with me my entire life was gone in a flash. You know, and I felt this motivation I had never felt before, and I was just on top of the world, and I was like, let's clean the bathroom. And I might want to go to medical school in about 3 or 4 years. Let's go ahead and start that admissions essay. I remember sitting at my desk at my computer in my room and, like, telling my sister, like, yeah, I'm typing my essay, and this is some good stuff, like groundbreaking. I mean, you're not going to believe it. And I remember thinking, like, this is it. Like, here's what I've been looking for my whole life. You know, and right away, I pulled out that bottle, and I was like, so how many of these do I get? And I automatically started doing the math. And I was like, well, they're supposed to last about this long, so if I take this many a day, this should last me a good 10 days. Okay. But from that first instant, looking back, I now know that I was hooked. And I think a common delusion, something I hear a lot in the rooms, is this idea that drugs and alcohol are the problem. But I have to tell you, for me, in that instant, it was my solution. It was all I had. I couldn't see the ultimate lie that it was. I couldn't see that, you know, in a single pill I completely blocked myself off from the power that would later be necessary to save my life. I didn't see any of that. All I saw was, I feel better. And, you know, so this turned into a shoulder surgery, which of course turned into more drugs. And I remember getting out of the hospital and, you know, I feel the need to add, up until this point, I was a pretty good child. You know, I don't think I really broke the rules a whole lot. There were some arguments and things here and there and some groundings, but nothing major. I really wasn't a drinker in high school. I didn't go party. It's just not my experience. But I remember getting out of the hospital from the surgery and thinking, I wish I knew somebody that could get me some more of that morphine stuff. Like, where can I get it? And immediately plotting, you know, and going back to the doctor a few weeks after the surgery and, oh, I'm still in pain and I'm almost out of Vicodin. And, you know, even at that point, like already exaggerating my pain, because frankly, it's nothing that some Advil wouldn't have handled looking back. You know, and it took a while for it to really take over and start to run my life. I do know that any time something happened, you know, if Libby accidentally slammed her hand in the car door, it'd be like, oh, there's a little bruise there. Well, technically that could be broken. I really should see a doctor, and really I should see this one because she always writes the prescription that I like. And it just kind of went off and on like that for years, you know, and I stayed in college. My grades in college kind of went up and down, and I did really well for a while, you know, and my interest in science and things like biology and chemistry and neuroscience really never left me. The truth is that science is one of the loves of my life. I still love it. But that was one thing that was not enough to stop what was happening in my spirit. You know, another thing that wasn't enough to stop me was my family. And I have to tell you guys, I love my family more than my own life, probably. I share such a deep connection with my mother, for example, you know, that it's hard to imagine that not being enough to stop me. But this book says, you know, frothy emotional appeal is just not sufficient. And it wasn't. And it just, you know, it slowly progressed over the years. And I've often kind of sat back and tried to think, you know, when did I really cross that line and lose the power to choose? And the answer is I don't know. And the other answer is that it really doesn't matter. What matters is that that's what happened. And I got to this point where I could not differentiate the true from the false. You know, if somebody asked me if I was in pain, I would say yes, and I would absolutely believe it to the core of my being. And it wasn't true half the time. You know, and ultimately what happened was I wound up causing a lot more problems for myself by kind of faking all these various illnesses, and I'm that girl that, like, loved to go to the hospital. You know, surgery was a good thing to me. I was like, sweet, how many days will this get me in there? I'm also the girl who, when they said, okay, well, you know, whatever's going on with you, it's better, you can go home. Oh, no, 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 I don't think I'm better. I think I might need to stay. And it was like that at first, and then it got into, like, I would throw these horrendous fits when they tried to send me home and just cry and scream and wail and talk about the futility of existence, and it was completely ridiculous. And still just did not see what was happening to me. I could not see that that power to choose against this was gone and that I had no choice. You know, and it continued to progress in the way that many of you guys who are in here and who are in the audience, you know, in the way that it does with us. You know, it continues to get worse, never better. And after some time, you know, I realized, yeah, there's a little bit of a problem here. Like, I'm sick and I'm shaking and I'm throwing up when I wake up in the morning. And, like, perhaps this isn't normal. You know, maybe I should lay off this a little bit. And I would try and I might make it for a day or two. But those thoughts would come rushing back, that malicious beast that was in my soul would come rushing back, and I would be not so much even driven by the physical illness, which anybody who's come off of opiates, it's pretty intense, but it really was that mental and spiritual darkness that I could not deal with, and I would do whatever it took to get more so that I didn't have to feel that. And of course, you know, some external consequences are beginning to pile up at this point. Got arrested because my husband at the time, ex-husband now, and I essentially stole some money from the college I was attending. And, you know, me being the really smart girl that I am, had it all wrapped up in this huge tapestry of not only lies to others, but self-delusion, to where I could even convince myself that wasn't stealing. And so the time came that I got arrested for this. I was at the courthouse paying for a parking ticket or something, and essentially they knew I was going to be there, and, you know, I left the courthouse in handcuffs. And the depth of my delusion was this. You know, I had a bottle of what I needed kind of in the glove compartment of my car, and I started asking the police officer, like, can we just stop by my car? Please, can we just stop by my car? Like, I don't know how long I'm going to be in here. I don't know what my dad's going to do when he finds out about this. Like, I could be here a while. I need what's in there. Unbeknownst to me, I got arrested in the one county in Texas where they actually allow you to have a narcotic prescription if you have it with you. So it's really kicking myself by the time I got into that holding cell, and, you know, just another evidence of the power of the delusion of this disease is there was another young lady in this cell who was essentially coming off of some methamphetamines, and was really hungry and was banging her tray around, and, you know, I was kind of afraid of her. So I offered her my plate, and I remember thinking, like, look at that drug addict. Meanwhile, I'm sitting there, like, pouring sweat, trying not to shake, like, can't keep my legs still. And so, as luck would have it, my parents decided that everyone gets one get-out-of-jail-free card, and I did get out about 12 hours later. And the first thing I did when I got to my car was find that bottle and pour whatever was in there down my throat. and I still had no clue I had a problem, just so deluded. You know, and that's just one example. Another good example I can give of just the power of the disease and the power of what is ultimately behind this disease. Like I said, I got married, and I thought that was one other thing that would fix it. Well, I just need a husband. I need a guy. That'll fix it. And that was not a conscious thought at the time. But deep down, you know, I knew. And I thought, well, if we just have a really nice apartment and we get all these really nice things off my bridal registry and it'll look just the right way in here, then I'll be okay. You know, and we'll both finish school at some point. And guess what? It wasn't okay. You know, I thought I could make this person into everything I wanted a man to be. And I was actually pretty successful at changing this person, and I was still miserable, and by the end, so was he. And, you know, there is a lot that plays into that. And I blamed this person for a long time. I blamed him for that money that was stolen. I blamed him for everything. When in reality, I was the instigator behind so much of it. You know, and this person truly loved me. I believe that he did. So, of course, that went up in flames, as many of my plans often did at that time. And so we wound up splitting up. And not too long after we split up, you know, really my usage is so out of control at this point, it's sort of a blur, so hopefully I get this timeline correct. But, you know, we split up and my drug usage just skyrocketed. I remember moving back to my parents' house and, like, hearing my mom kind of come downstairs in the evenings, you know, basically to see if I was still breathing or not. And just passing out random places, like waking up with my face stuck to the toilet seat. I mean, all kinds of just, you know, scary things. And, like, it's been 12 hours. Like, how did I get here? Things like that. And really no idea how I'd gotten there. So this kind of brought about the first, like, intervention, so to speak. I use that word for lack of a better one. But, you know, we decided maybe it was time for Libby to get some treatment. And, you know, we had talked about it before, and I was always like, oh, yeah, yeah, guys, you know, I'll stop, I'll tone it down. And I tried to, you know, I tried, like, slowly tapering my dosage down or, like, trying a lower level narcotic. And it always ended one of two ways, you know. Either it steadily crept back up to where it was, or either I got to where I couldn't take the way I felt my own skin, and I just went on a binge, and there I was again. So, trip one to treatment. And this is where that delusion that the drugs are the problem comes in. You know, and I went in there really believing, by this time my ex-husband has been diagnosed with colon cancer, you know, and he's about 30 years old. And we're still not sure how this court stuff is going to pan out. Like, there's a possibility I could go to jail. And so I really believed, I was like, the anxiety about the fact that I might go to jail, that's where the Xanax habit came from. Yep, I need that. And this, you know, I don't know what's going to happen to this man, and am I ultimately responsible for all the crap I put him through? You know, I believed deep down that that's why I couldn't stop. That coupled with, well, I'm really physically addicted to this stuff, and detox is a gnarly thing, and, you know, let me just get a little bit of professional help, we'll detox, and it'll be good, right? Because the drugs are the problem. Not the case. You know, the second I got off those detox meds, that irritability, that restlessness, that discontentedness came right back. And I could not figure out why. So I decided it was the place I was in. I was like, well, it's their fault. So let me, you know, write an essay on why opiates are the most effective antidepressants in science. And why everyone should take them, frankly. Or here's how our TV time should go. Like, let's do it this way. And I mean, I believed it, and I had these elaborate things, and it was full of like 5-syllable words, and on the surface, it sounded great. And I was like, look at me, I'm back. I can actually pronounce these words again, like I'm sober, okay. So, you know, I got out and I went to a sober house, and I remember having several conversations with my dad actually and just feeling like there was something wrong with me, you know, and still not able to figure it out. And, you know, we would have these just diatribes about it and about literature and about different terms that people had labeled this internal icky feeling. And things kind of described it accurately. You know, so then came the delusion that, oh, it must be self-knowledge. Well, now I understand this, and I have a label to put on it, so I'm good to go. But it wasn't the case. You know, the day came again when I, once again, could not differentiate the true from the false. And a little opportunity popped up. And at first I was like, well, no, I mean, things got kind of rough before. Like, maybe I shouldn't do that. That didn't last long. Because what I did not understand was that I lacked the power to make the choice against it, and that inevitably it was going to happen. So then came the next delusion. Well, I'll control it this time. It's been out of my system for a while. Like, this is going to be under control. I'm going to find some kind of pain management program because of the shoulder. And I'll just take, like, a normal dose the rest of my life, and things will be good. Not the case, you know. On day two, it was back to, like, 30 of these pills a day, and it just progressed from there. And that was the second day. And it just did not take long. So, of course, you know, the suspicions start to arise within my family again. And by this point, my ex-husband has passed away. And so I remember thinking, there's the trump card. There's what I can use. So if you had been through this, you would be doing this too. Like, anybody that had my life would be doing this. And it really began to spiral out of control. And, you know, I started missing things I was supposed to be present for. Just the same old story over and over again. Only it didn't take 8 years this time. It took a few months before I was right there again. And, you know, eventually it came out in the family, like, yeah, this is what's going on, you know. And I think that I acted pretty upset that they knew and talked about maybe wanting to go to detox. But secretly I was glad. I thought, well, now they know, and now I can use the way I've really been wanting to use, and I don't have to worry about detection. It did not take long from there for things to go down pretty much in flames. As I recall, it took about a week. And it wound up with me totaling yet another brand new car that had been bought for me, basically falling asleep on the road, could not remember how to get home. I still don't remember the events of this night. I know that there were some sparks coming out of the car at one point. They couldn't find anyone to tow it because it was that much of a risk. And it was one of those moments where it's like, how did you walk away from this alive? And again, I have to believe that's the grace of God, because despite my best efforts at killing myself, basically, and killing the pain, God had a different plan for my life. And what it took to get my attention was something really dramatic. And that's what happened. And I remember getting kicked out of my house, basically, and a really a long night ensued. And I'm not going to go into the details, but it was a long night, I'm sure, for my family. And lo and behold, the next day, I'm going to Austin. My dad said, well, I found this place. Now it's 90 days. It's not 30. And, you know, I think I asked some questions. And what I really remember is it being described as an upscale ranch. So in my mind, I'm picturing, like, tennis courts and horseback rides in the sunset and, you know, a nice massage after breakfast. And sure, Dad, I'd love to go there. It sounds great. Like, what do they do as far as detox, though? You know, immediately concerned with the drugs. And coming down here again thinking, like, these drugs are the problem. I don't know why I can't kick this habit. I don't know why I can't stop. It must be willpower. I need to go to detox again, get it cleared out, and I'll never go back. Just such powerful delusion. Which brings us to the fateful Saturday that Marcia mentioned earlier. I believe that I was fully unable to speak or to respond to anything that anyone said to me. And I remember my dad pulling up in the truck, and one of my last kind of lucid thoughts was I screamed at my dad, and I was like, what kind of place have you brought me to? I saw the farmhouse and like thought the farmhouse was the entire recovery center. I was like, what is this? Like, what have you done? Yeah, so I had to leave and take a little trip to detox and come back. And that kind of brings me to where I started off with that night of the alumni reunion and seeing these happy people and, you know, what this man said to me that just brought me a shred of hope at the time that was really quickly forgotten. I remember being told, welcome to the Navy SEALs of recovery. And I was like, what does that mean? Like, we're going to have to, I guess, have some gym time or... And so I think they took it easy on me for a little while. I was still taking some detox meds at the time. And the biggest problem I faced in the first, what, 2 or 3 weeks was physically staying awake. I remember being in groups and, like, praying before a group would start. Like, God, just please let me stay awake. And every time I would fall asleep and my big book would hit the floor and I'm like, no, it happened again, and Marcia would just clap her hand. Wake up, Libby! You know, I'd be like, what? I'm awake. What's going on? You know, and I remember seeing, like, the highlighter kind of trail off the page, because I would fall asleep as I was reading my book, and, you know, on the surface, like, oh, guys, I'm so on board with this. You know, I'm glad to be here. And then as soon as nobody was looking, just doing whatever I wanted. You know, I had no experience with a lot of life skills at that point. Things had been long forgotten. One thing that comes to mind quickly is sweeping a broom. Apparently, Libby was not very adept at that. And I literally had a contract that required me to... So we had this, you know, work ethic. Some of you guys know what I'm talking about. And my chore and work ethic for an entire week was to sweep and kind of bono the floors upstairs while my sweeping coach watched. And she would follow me around and be like, you missed like a tiny spot right there. There might be a fleck of dust. And I was like, really? What does this have to do with my drug problem? You know, I couldn't see. And it's like, okay, well, that's over. Let's eat some breakfast, and now we're going to go to this group called Circle. I'm like, what's Circle, guys? You know, and right away, these people start bringing me these concerns. Like, Libby, when you do this, I feel anger and just dead away getting slammed. And, you know, this went on every day for weeks. And I was like, I'm trying. Like, what do you want from me? I don't know what you want. And I kept, like, just running smack dab into something at every turn. And I could not figure out what it was. I was like, what is it that's blocking me from getting what these other people seem to have? And I truly could not understand it. You know, I tried everything I could think of to try. No, I mean, if I missed, like, taking the trash out of one trash can during work ethic, it was like, slammed in Circle. Like, this is not fair. Like, you know, what is this place? I remember complaining a lot about gym, too. So we're pushing a sled with like 300 pounds on it up a hill. Again, what does this have to do with the fact that I can't stop taking pills? Didn't see it. You know, the idea of perhaps a holistic approach to alcoholism and addiction being beneficial did not cross my mind. Did not get it. And eventually what I came to figure out was that impenetrable wall that I kept running up against. Ultimately, I was running up against myself and my own selfishness and my own ego and my own pride. And that was like the very layer of gunk and filth that was blocking me off from this thing that had been there all along. You know, I was just too blind and too egotistical to see it. I remember telling my dad, I think it was my dad, that, you know, I wasn't sure about this whole God thing. You know, keeping in mind that I essentially grew up a Southern Baptist and God was no new concept to me at this point. And not seeing, like, the number of ways in which God had already saved my life countless times. You know, the reality is that I should have been dead the night before I came in here. By all mathematical, statistical explanations, I should not have walked away from that. And I couldn't see it. So along comes the fourth step. You know, and Marcia just keeps telling me to do things. I'm like, but I don't feel better. You know, cue another delusion. Like, when I think differently or when I start to feel differently, like, maybe I'll start doing what you say. But until then, no. You know, and I could not see that I had it all backwards. I just could not see that. Luckily, I had a lot of help with steps 4, 5, 6, and 7. And, you know, in that second trip through steps 5, 6, and 7, something happened. And, you know, I was able to tell somebody everything, all these deep, dark secrets and some of the things I'm talking about now that absolutely blow my mind to be able to stand up here and say openly to a room full of people. Things that I had clung to so tightly were dispelled just like that. And during that trip through 6 and 7, I remember hitting my knees and asking God, like, each defect that was listed on that sheet, you know, I humbly ask you to remove this or use it for your benefit and the benefit of your people. And that pretty much took up the entire hour, but something happened. And I started to feel like I wasn't alone in that room. And, you know, the next month came around and my parents were able to come visit, which was another hot issue, by the way. There was an argument about the first month whether or not my parents could come, and I threw an absolute fit and, you know, went and sat on the porch and cried and smoked about 27 cigarettes in a row. You know, but they came and I had the chance to actually make amends to my parents, and that was the second experience I got with real freedom. And I remember telling somebody later that day, like, oh, okay, so this is what it feels like to actually almost maybe kind of be okay in my own skin. You know, and that was my first experience with any real freedom from this bondage of self that I had, you know, unbeknownst to me, been enslaved to for years. And that gave me just enough faith to take the next step. You know, so I got out and I was afraid. I was in this new city. But somehow deep down I knew that God had a plan. And I knew that it was something that was beyond what I could imagine. You know, I also knew that I didn't have a car anymore. So I knew that was going to look a lot like riding the bus. But I had the privilege of going to a really cool sober house, and I was one of the first residents to actually live there when it opened. And I later wound up running that sober house, which is, you know, another testament to the power of this program. But I remember thinking, like, really? I've done all this work to ride the bus, okay? you know, and of course, one of the expectations was to go look for a job. And so I wound up working. It was right around Christmas, and I wound up working at this little boot Western store. For those of you who know me, not a cowgirl. I might be from Fort Worth, Texas, but that gene did not rub off on me, I guess. You know, and right away, some of those thoughts started to creep back in. I'd had an awakening as a result of this work I had, and I knew deep down that God had some kind of awesome plan for my life. But every now and then, I'd start thinking, like, I was going to go to medical school, and now I'm selling boots? Like, you know, but as fate would have it, that job didn't last too long. And some people know that story. you know, but I had many opportunities for growth. You know, I actually learned about the bus system, which was something that was foreign to me. And, you know, I had some experiences on that, too. I got really lost one night and, like, wound up in way South Austin outside of, like, the Del Valle Jail. And my phone was dead, and I could barely, like, text the house manager to let her know I was going to be late. And, you know, so it's about midnight, and I'm walking up this hill, and it's freezing cold, and it's all misty outside. And, you know, I went in just really upset, like, screw this, dude. But that was just one more experience that I later was able to pull from. As luck, fate, God would have it, I did wind up running that house, and I can't tell you how many women came to me with that screw the bus issue. By then I had had some help getting a car, and you know, things were much better for me, and I had a better job. But I was able to say, like, hey, I've done that too. You know, and that was one of my first real experiences with something that was directly correlative to an experience I had had in the past that enabled me to really be helpful to somebody else. And, you know, I see God in that. When you're able to transmit something that you've been through to someone else, there's an effect produced from that, you know, and I found that early on. Another way I found that was I began sponsoring other women. You know, and having been such a problem child, quote, during my 90 days here, really, you know, it's funny now. It was life or death then. You know, there's a little story that some of you guys know. You know, I literally was ready to throw myself off the balcony in hopes that I would break enough bones and get a few Vicodin out of it. And I remember thinking, like, if I get really lucky, you know, maybe I'll hit my head on a really big rock and this will just be done. You know, so it's funny and it's jokes, but that side of it is not funny to me. I was brought back from the gates of insanity and death. There's nothing more insane than thinking, how many bones do I need to break on my own to get a few pills? And now it is funny to me. You know, but the reality is that there are people out there that are dying right and left. I had a friend back home die of an overdose a few weekends ago. Out of nowhere. He had been sober for a little while. He used one last time and that was it. You know, he doesn't get to come back. And the work that's done here is so important and so, so serious. You know, and I think that recovery is all about fun and being happy, joyous, and free, but it's also about saving lives. Not everyone gets the chance to come back. You know, that next trip out could be the last, and I'm really clear on that today. And if I can communicate anything through all of this, I would want to say that, you know, no matter how far down the scale you might feel like you've gone, no matter how many terrible things you might feel like you've done, no matter who you might want to blame this on, this program and this solution and this benevolent creator is available to everybody. And let me tell you guys something. I have a pretty awesome life today. I have a really cool job. I get to help women who are just coming out of treatment, you know, and help them navigate these things. And that's made it so clear, like, why my path in treatment, you know, and first getting out, like, why it was so arduous. Well, here's why. You know, there's almost nothing that one of those people can go through that I haven't been through on some level. You know, and I have a solution to that, and I get to share that solution with people for a living. You know, and to look back from being the antisocial girl sitting crying in that corner, you know, and everyone wondering, like, what is up with her? From being that girl to being one that can come up here and talk about all of this tonight and get to carry this message basically for a living, you know, and get to sponsor other women and get to be used by a higher power to literally save lives. You know, it's nothing short of miraculous, and it's nothing short of remarkable. I can't tell you guys, like, how many calls and text messages I got today with, you know, hey, Libby, wishing you luck, or I'll be there tonight, or I'm thinking about you. I didn't have any friends when I got here. Even the people that I initially met when I first got here didn't like me. I had no friends the first month I was in this treatment center, I'm pretty sure. You know, like, who is she? This concept of a physical allergy, for example. You know, I remember thinking in my head, well, they don't understand the biological components of what constitutes a true allergic reaction. Like, let me, you know, just thinking I had a whole lot of ideas. Out of options, but not out of ideas. And if there's something else I could wish for you guys, I'm rambling a little bit. But it would be that you run out of options and out of ideas. It's a pretty hopeless place to be, but it's where I had to get, you know. And when I finally gave up, not even the power, but when I gave up the delusion of power, because I really had none, let's be clear, I had none. When I gave that up was when I first started to regain a little bit of power. And that power that I've been seeking my whole life, I have quite a bit of it in my life today. And I have a whole lot of friends today. You know, I see a lot of them in this audience. And with that, it really is such an honor to be back here. There is a spirit about this place that's hard to find many other places. You know, and there's some work that goes on here that I believe in that is real work. And when I get to come back here and even look at, you know, I know a few of the current residents, but when I get to come and listen to a fifth step and that little tiny moment when the lights click on in somebody's eyes, you know, and they start to get it, and I know that God has been kind enough to allow me to be a part of that moment, those are the things that make it all worth it. So thank you guys so much. I'm really glad to be back here. Thank you.